is the answer to pretty much nothing.
The latest on Iraq on the world.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to start today by talking about the ongoing violence in Iraq. As you probably know, militants belonging to a radical Islamist group known as ISIS have captured some key cities throughout Iraq. ISIS stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and the group's takeover of important cities, including Mosul, Tikrit, and Tal Afar, are central to their goal of controlling Iraq's resources as well as territory. There's growing concern that this al-Qaeda offshoot may be closing in on Iraq's capital city of Baghdad. The U.S. State Department has begun evacuating some personnel, and much of the debate in the U.S. is about what the U.S.'s role should be, but we wanted to know more about the group and about conditions in Iraq for the people who are caught in this latest turmoil. So we have called Farnaz Fasihi. She's the Deputy Middle East Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. She spent years covering events in Iraq, and she's with us now from Beirut, Lebanon. Farnaz, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Good to be with you.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Tariq Abu Kumra. He's an Iraqi living in the U.S. He was an interpreter there for the U.S. military until he had to flee the country because of threats against his life. And he's with us now from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Tariq Abu Kumra, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Farnaz, let me start with you. There are reports that the U.S. is considering engaging Iran on how to address the situation in Iraq. And I think everybody knows that the U.S. and Iran have a very tense relationship. So why would the two work together on this?
Iran and the U.S. have a mutual interest in crushing al-Qaeda movements in the region because they both view it as a security threat. Iran is a Shia government. ISIS and al-Qaeda offshoots are sworn enemies of Shia, so this is an existential threat for Iran. And the U.S. also does not want to see the legacy left behind in Iraq be tarnished by Islamist Sunni groups taking, 40% or half of Iraq's territory and establishing a state. It could potentially also be a very destabilizing factor in the Middle East. So there's a common interest to make sure that the Iraqi government is able to survive and that stability is returned to Iraq.
Tariq, I think people knew that this group, ISIS, was operating in Syria. But I think it has been a shock to many people here on this side of the water that this group has been able to function so aggressively and ruthlessly in moving into Iraq. But I wanted to know, for the family you had in Iraq, was this something that was discussed? Was there concern before the rest of us caught on to this, that this group was plotting some movement in Iraq?
Well, having militias in Iraq is not a new thing, and the presence of al-Qaeda and such extremist group has been since 2004. Mm-hmm. So people were used to these kind of confrontations, especially in 2006 when the sectarian war began. But for now, people have been in a pretty calm situation for a few years, and I think what happened is just a crisis in the military organization, a whole army that was supposed to stop these extremists just deserted and everyone left his post. So I think that's why they controlled the city. It's not that they are new to here, but they did not have any resistance.
Had the Iraqi army gained the confidence of the population? Or your family members, those who've been there, are you surprised that they did desert their posts, that they did disappear?
Well, yes. People were surprised because it was so fast. It's not like, few units left their posts and then, it gradually happened. It's like all of a sudden all the 85,000, reportedly 85,000 soldiers left their posts. But I think it's a leadership a problem because leadership is not acknowledging that there's a problem in this military organization. Corruption has been, in this police and army forces for years, and people were indicating that, but the leadership is not really acknowledging the problem. Now they're recruiting more volunteers because the Shia imams had this fatwa of jihad, so they have to stop all of these extremists. So now they're recruiting just volunteers who are not trained, who are, young guys. So I don't think it's going to fix the problem, actually, because if an army with all the equipment they had and all the firepower, they couldn't stop those guys, or they fled, what would a few volunteers or a few thousand volunteers do?
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Tariq Abu Kumra. He's a former translator for the U.S. military in Iraq, and Farnaz Fasihi, a journalist, and we're talking about the ongoing situation in Iraq. Farnaz, what can you help us understand this? I mean, Tariq was just telling us that there have been militias in the country, you know, for years, really. But right. Now, but this group seems they seem very well organized. They seemed very directed. They seem to have had very clear kind of strategy. So that suggests that they're really functioning not so much as a militia, but really kind of as an army. And so the question then becomes, what is this about? Is the root of this the sectarian division, or is it something else?
This group is indeed organized. It's perhaps the most extremist Sunni Salafi movement in the region. But they did not act in isolation and out of pocket. The reason that ISIS was able to gain so much territory in Iraq as opposed to Syria is because there was roots of sectarian division in Iraq, because the Sunnis of Iraq, from the beginning of the U.S.-led invasion until the Shia-led government of Mr. Maliki, the Sunnis have been marginalized. They feel like they don't have a stake or a future in the current Iraqi political system. That together with the threat of the militant groups, what happened with ISIS was that they were able to tap into this feeling of resentment, and they were able to get the support of Sunni tribes. They were able to get the support of Sunni residents of these cities and other militant Sunni militant groups that have been fighting in Iraq for a long time. In addition, a lot of the army soldiers, a lot of the members who fled their posts were Sunnis. So it's shaping into really a Sunni factional war, not just ISIS against the government.
Tariq, do we have any sense of what are the cities where this group has now taken control? What are people's conditions there? Do you know whether people are able to get food, or are the basic city sort of services functioning, like electricity and water? What do we know about that?
So there are like conflicting information, because I think, you know, there is no source of truth in this case, for at least that I know of. But I've been hearing that some people in Mosul actually are happier right now, because they've been in kind of living in a fortress for the past few years because of all the, you know, the army and police checkpoints, and people are really choked in their daily life. So now that these guys came in and they have removed all of those posts and military, so people are feeling a little bit more freedom. However, this is not going to continue for sure, because this group has always been a very radical and extremist, and they have always noted that, you know, they're going to enforce the Sharia law.
I was going to ask you about that. What have they communicated to the people in these areas that they have taken over about their intentions? It's our understanding that they want to establish, you know, an Islamic State, as their name would imply, that would stretch from Iraq into northern Syria. We understand that there have been some summary executions, that they have singled out people who are associated with the police and the government. But as you've mentioned, that there is no source of truth. Have they communicated
exactly
their plans? Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's an example, which is Syria, and we all know what happened, and they're going to do the exact same thing, which when they enforce Sharia laws, that means everyone who kind of contradicts them or just cross them, he will get killed or executed, and they will, you know, every woman has to wear all of the veils and all of these things that we got used to in Syria now going to happen again.
Mm. Farnaz, could I have some sort of final thoughts from you? What are some of the things that we should be looking at in the days ahead? What are the kinds of things that you're going to be following, people who want to keep following this story? What should we be paying attention to?
I think we should be paying attention to the massacres like we saw yesterday, reports of ISIS rounding up over 1,700 Shia young men from the Air Force and mass executing them. I think that you know, the same threat could be reversed. I mean, there's a lot of Shia volunteer militia organizing, and they could very easily take revenge on innocent Sunni civilians. So I think because of the history that Iraq has had in the past decade of sectarian war, we have to pay attention that this doesn't escalate into a, you know, neighbor-on-neighbor sort of, man-on-man situation that we had in 2006-2007. The politics of the region are also very interesting. You know, Iran is and the U.S. are meeting in under the umbrella of the nuclear talks in Vienna today, so it'll be interesting to see if they will talk about Iraq and what sort of cooperation we'll see from that front.
Tariqa, final thought, if I may. I understand that you have some family visiting from Iraq at the moment. Are they able to stay and until the situation becomes more stable, or will they be required to go back into this chaotic circumstance?
So, yes, I have my parents visiting, and actually my sister here is on a student visa as well. But, you know, for now, I can't send them back because of all this situation. And the problem is that this situation is not going to, you know, it's kind of irreversible. I think we're getting back to the sectarian war again, especially after these fatwas. So I'm going to try to keep them as much as I can, and we'll see what happens.
Tariq Abu Kumra is an Iraqi who used to work as a translator for the United States military in Iraq, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR West, which is in Culver City, California. Farnaz Fasihi is the deputy Middle East editor for the Wall Street Journal. We reached her in Beirut. Thank you so much, both of you, for your insights today.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, social media is buzzing after singer R. Kelly's 13-year-old revealed that he is transgender. But others are asking, why is that anybody's business but his own?
Transgender stories have always been framed in this very sensational way.
Janet Mock, a former celebrity journalist and a transgender activist now, will join us to give her perspective on how stories about transgender youth should be covered. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, a guide to saving for retirement when it's decades away, and it starts with skipping that latte.
Pay yourself first, and what I mean by that is just putting that money away into the 401k plan and just pretend it's gone forever.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
On the next American Experience, in 1961, segregation seemed to have an overwhelming grip on American society, but an integrated band of college students decided to risk everything and head to the Deep South. They called themselves the Freedom Riders, and they managed to bring the president and the American public face-to-face with the challenge of correcting civil rights inequities that plagued the nation. Watch Freedom Riders on American Experience, Tuesday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we'd like to talk about President Obama's recent trip to Indian country. On Friday, President Obama and the First Lady visited the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. It was the president's first visit to Indian country as president, and as part of the visit, he laid out a plan to improve Native American schools that are federally funded. The plan will redesign the Bureau of Indian Education to focus more on professional development, teacher and principal retention, and intervention for failing students. And the plan is also intended to honor tribal leaders' longstanding request for more tribal authority in education. We wanted to hear more about all of this, so we're joined now by Anawake Rose. She is the Executive Director of the National Indian Education Association. She's also a member of the Cherokee Nation. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It was an historic visit in that it was the president's first as president, but it wasn't just a love fest. I mean, he was calling attention to some serious issues, including, for example, he highlighted the dropout rate of Native American students, which he said is nearly twice the national rate, and he called that number a, quote, moral call to action. So I wanted to ask, overall, how was that message received?
We're really excited. You know, the fact that the state of emergency that Native education is in is finally reaching the president's level is something that all the tribal leaders and our Native educators and communities are standing up and applauding.
Yeah, there were a lot of bureaucratic initiatives that were talked about here, which I think is going to be a lot of complicated for people to wrap their heads around. Can you just pick out one or two things that you think will make a difference?
So I think there's two things that folks should really understand. One is that Native people never gave up what they wanted to do to educate their citizens. This was something that was taken from them. So the concept of self-determination and tribes being able to run and control their school systems again is huge. It's something that tribal leaders and educators have been asking for a long time. So reinvigorating that concept of self-determination and sovereignty of our education systems. The second piece is really BIE getting out of the business of educating, right? Tribes being able to run their day-to-day education and BIE becoming a resource center, something that will really allow the tribes to have a place to go to for capacity building and for best practices. General information like the comprehensive centers provide the local education agencies and the state education agencies, but tribes have really not had any access to.
So what's going to be different now?
Oh, so many things are going to be different. First, we're going to have, under this concept of self-determination, the tribes being able to really determine how our schools are going to be delivering our education, which includes language and culture. You know, is the tribe going to determine to make a culturally infused curriculum for their students? And that's now up to our tribal leaders to determine and not up to BIE.
How do people be the Bureau of Indian Education? What is the sense, though, of this whole question of, on the one hand, you know, a lot of people want local control, but there's also a sense that, I mean, that's kind of part of the American tradition. And in the case of Indian country, I think a lot of people are aware that a lot of people have very negative relationship with centrally controlled education, with, you know, kids being taken away from their parents, kids being sent to schools where they were barred from speaking, you know, their traditional languages, were actually made to feel shame, you know, about their heritage. Some people have some very negative and traumatic experiences related to this. On the one hand, you have to assume that people want their kids to be able to compete on the world stage, just like kids who live anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Well, how is that balancing act to be? How is that balancing act to be met? I mean, for example, will schools then try meet Common Core standards now going forward? How is that going to work?
So that's a really interesting question, too. BIE has actually not adopted Common Core. So this is one of the pieces within their blueprint that they're going to be moving forward and thinking about adoption of Common Core. What that will mean for tribes is that tribes will now have this ability to lean back on the shoulders of BIE and say, okay, now we're going to develop our own assessments around this baseline of standards, which will include questions that they really want their students to know, right? They'll be able to think about nonfiction from tribal authors. So really creating a curriculum that's infused with knowledge that we think that our students need to know while still meeting those world-class standards, right? So we're going to have leaders now that are able to come back and work within our communities that have these, you know, prestigious, you know, 6-year, 8-year degrees from Harvard or wherever, but really being able to have world-class based education that's driven from the tribe's perspective.
They can't do that now? Are you saying that schools now, if they want to embrace Native American authors, they cannot do that now if they receive federal funding?
So it's challenging in the way that they're able to develop their curriculum. They still have to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind. You know, they still have a lot of pieces that are being dictated to them from the BIE. And so that's where a lot of this movement and this transformation will be taking place, to really allow the tribes to be able to dictate what that's going to look like within their schools.
As we mentioned earlier, that there is this history of mistrust based on practices that I think many people understand are discredited today, even if they are believed to have been well-intentioned, that created kind of a great deal of trauma. Do you feel that there is an attitude of trust now?
So there's a lot of skepticism, right? There's some concerns. BIE has done some realignment and adjustments in the past that haven't been exactly aligned with what tribes have asked for. So what the National Indian Education Association will be doing is working very closely with BIE to make sure that the implementation is taking place in the best way possible. They have five circles of pieces they're going to be rolling out, and we're going to be working with them to make sure that that implementation is done through consultation and making sure that tribes are involved every step of the way.
You've been involved with the government in sort of policy positions, working in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, for example. Has there been a change over the time that you have been involved kind of in policy in this area? I mean, it would seem that there are now people of Native American heritage who are involved in these agencies. Why does it take that long to change? Is it that they're just habits of relationship that just need to be changed? Is this a policy issue? Is this a matter of the way that the relationship are constructed legally? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So since the administration has changed, President Obama has really been instrumental in highlighting the concerns that are around Native education. Secretary Jewell and Secretary Duncan, from almost the moments that they stepped into office, were paying attention to what was going on with Native education. For the last 2 years, BIE has been going out to consultation and asking tribes, we're going to make this fix. What does it look like? So this blueprint that you're looking at is actually quite a long process of steps that has been taking place and making sure that they've got it right before they've rolled it out. So change within Indian country is slow because it's something that the federal government's really making sure that tribes are involved in and included in. They don't want to mess up again.
Fine, we have about a minute left. That dropout rate issue that we talked about, how confident are you that if you and I were to get together 5 years from now, that a dent will have been made in that? Is that a priority?
Oh, absolutely. It's a priority. Making sure if tribes have a definite say-so about how the education system is going to be done, how their schools are going to be taught, then yes, there will be a dent made.
Do you feel confident?
Absolutely.
Anawake Rose is the executive director of the National Indian Education Association. She was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Anawake, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
We first spoke with writer and editor Janet Mock back in 2011 when she first wrote about her experiences as a transgender woman for the magazine Marie Claire. For many people, that article was the first exposure they'd had to an in-depth discussion of the life of a transgender person. Since then, a lot has happened in the realm of transgender rights and activism, including the disclosure of the transgender identities of a number of celebrity children. So we thought this would be a good time to bring Janet Mock back. She authored a memoir earlier this year called Redefining Realness, and she's with us now from New York. Janet, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me back.
Since we spoke with you back in 2011, as I mentioned, a number of people have come out and kind of come to the fore in public consciousness. I mean, recently, the actress Laverne Cox has been put on the cover of Time magazine, has made a big splash with the Netflix original series Orange is the New Black. And you, of course, for people who may not remember this, there was a lot of discussion around an interview you did with a former CNN host named Piers Morgan around the publication of your book, where you felt that you were asked some questions that were just way more personal than you felt would have been asked of someone of a different background or identity. When you look at this all together, how do you feel the conversation around transgender identity is going? Do you feel encouraged by it? Are you discouraged by it?
I'm completely encouraged. I think that when we have uncomfortable discourse, oftentimes that means that we're moving forward. We're all learning. We're trying to develop language. We're trying to teach each other. And I think that that particular instance with me on CNN was one point in which I think for one of the first times that a trans person in a space, in a public media space, pushed back and said that the way that you've been covering our lives for the past 60 years is no longer really advancing the conversation. And so how can we come to a space to speak across difference? How can we learn to not dehumanize trans people by talking about their body parts or their medical history? And so I'm completely encouraged by the conversation. I think it's one in which we're kind of having it on a national level, so it can kind of be a little scary for a lot of people, but I hope that it doesn't discourage people from wanting to be a part of the conversation.
One of the stories that we wanted to talk to you about is that it's been reported that J. Kelly, who is one of the children of the R&B star R. Kelly, has come out as transgender. And now, you know, R. Kelly is a very controversial and polarizing figure. He's been prosecuted for having inappropriate relationships with underage girls. He was acquitted for that. But J. Kelly, it's now been reported, has come out as a transgender boy. And this has become a very controversial issue in social media, in part because J. Kelly is only 13 years old. And this information was gleaned from apparently his social media sites. So the first question I had for you is, what's your top of the mind, you know, reaction to this story?
I'm just so icky talking about a 13-year-old. You know, that's how I kind of feel. And I think that the way that we, you know, as someone who worked in media, as you said, as a pop culture editor, I understand that sometimes children are fair game. But there's a part of me that feels a bit of ickiness and uncomfortability around the media kind of, in a sense, stalking or looking at this young person's social media accounts and then reporting on it just because their father is a celebrity, right? And a father that apparently has very little connection with Jay's life. But, you know, now that he is kind of a public figure because his father is a public figure, I think it teaches us a lot of lessons about the ignorance some media outlets have in terms of reporting on trans people's lives.
I do want to mention, by the way, that this was not reported in, you know, the New York Times, for example. I mean, this was a blog that specializes in not just celebrity coverage, but also a lot of dysfunctional behavior among regular people. I just have to say, I mean, it just, you know what I mean? There's a lot. This is not a major media outlet, but it has gotten the attention of other outlets, in part because other bloggers criticized the discussion. So the first thing you're uncomfortable with is just the fact of the reporting itself. And then what else?
And then, you know, just I think just the sense of agency, right? And how do we report on trans people's lives? And so this is a coming out story for a young transgender boy. Things that I think that we can learn and maybe take away from this is the idea that we need to respect people's names and pronouns. That includes like not calling J. Kelly R. Kelly daughter, but calling them R. Kelly's child. And there's different gender neutral terms that we can use. I think that also the idea of seeing trans as not so much a condition or a sickness or a choice or lifestyle, but seeing it as a part of our grander diversity as people. And I also think on another level too, the medical history and procedures. I think I saw a lot of coverage that talked about Jay's own medical transition, to say, right?
Or was speculating about whether a transition had taken place.
Yes, and I think that what I find so fascinating about Jay is his own handling of this situation in such a public way as such a young person. And I think like a lot of young trans people that I interact with online, he's choosing to live visibly through his Ask FM account where he allows people to ask him questions about being trans. And he's also using his parents' spotlight to educate people. And I saw him discussing policy on his Ask FM account, telling other young people that, you know, he uses a nurse's office as a locker room and as a restroom at school. Mm. And he also shows how family and how his family in particular has been very supportive of him. And I saw him, he states something about, you know, we need to use correct pronouns and names, and that his parents ask him about, or his mother, who's mm-hmm. very supportive supposedly, ask him what clothes that he wants to buy for himself. And he just says that he's appreciative of his family. And I think that this is a great way to model powerful behavior on supporting and affirming young trans people.
Do you feel that the mere fact that this reporting exists says something about interest in or something about how the transgender experience is viewed? Do you see what I'm saying? Do you feel that?
I do. I think there is something titillating about the idea of reporting that someone is transgender, right? And so I think transgender stories have always been framed in this very sensational way. And only some people come in to want to educate themselves and learn about the trans experience, and others just want to gawk and gaze. Mm. And we often know that gazing and curiosity doesn't really lead to much transformation of our culture and society. And what I love about this story particularly is that there is a African-American mother who is supportive of her LGBT child, her transgender child. And I think that we need more modeling of that within communities of color.
As I mentioned, we last spoke in 2011, and a lot has happened since then. I'm just more interested in just a final thought from you about where you think this is going. If we get together 3 years from now, what do you think we'll be talking about?
I think we'll be talking about that time when, you remember when our nation was talking about pronouns and we couldn't get over pronouns and what to call transgender people? I think that that's the space that we'll be in 3 years, because we'll realize that we need to just let all of us need to have the power to determine and declare and define ourselves for ourselves and for everyone around us, to respect our own definitions of self. And that's all that we're talking about here with trans people and identities. A lot of these things are big deals because around pronoun usage and around names, because for trans people, it's such a big deal for themselves. But I think overall, if we just respect people and call them by what they want to be called, we wouldn't have a lot of these big old dust-ups, I think, that we're having. And so I think that we'll hopefully advance in our language in a way that we can speak across difference and hopefully be more embracing of one another.
Janet Mock is a writer and a transgender activist. Her book, Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and So Much More, debuted on the New York Times bestseller list earlier this year, and she was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Janet Mock, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much, you all.
Coming up, we're learning about Freedom Summer, which was 50 years ago. The Civil Rights Act became law this summer, and law professor Randall Kennedy says it's easy to forget how important that was.
When I teach this material, there will be students who will say, "What's the big deal about getting a Coca-Cola?" And, you know, my response is, it was a real big deal.
Randall Kennedy tells us more about this underappreciated achievement of Freedom Summer. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org. From the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. From the estate of Miles Gatterman, whose bequest is a tribute to NPR's ongoing dedication to music and the arts. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
In your statement, you said that you came home and found your wife, that she was already dead?
Downstairs, yeah.
That's Deputy Sheriff Molly Salverson interviewing a suspect in the new FX series Fargo, based on the popular Coen Brothers film. On the next Fresh Air, we meet series creator and writer Noah Hawley and Allison Tolman, who plays the deputy. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
If you've been looking for a way to support WILL that's quick, convenient, and fits easily into your monthly budget, consider becoming a sustaining member. As a sustainer, your membership will always be current, which means no more renewal notices in the mail. This steady financial stream means more of your money can be spent on our great programming. For more information, go online to will.illinois.edu/support and click on Sustained Giving.
Hi, I'm Diane Noland, host of Mid-American Gardener on WILL-TV. Join me and my panel of experts each week as we discuss lawn and gardening care tailored to Zone 5 growing conditions. We'll also answer your gardening questions, so call in during the show or send an email for us to answer on the air. Join me for Mid-American Gardener Thursday nights at 7 on WILL-TV or listen Saturday mornings at 6:30 on AM 580.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Summer is upon us, and this is the time many of us like to kick back with a beach book or a big stack of magazines. But this summer marks the 50th anniversary of a number of pivotal events in the civil rights movement. It's known as Freedom Summer. So we decided to put some items on our reading list that explore the theme of freedom. Our next guest wrote a piece for Harper's Magazine about one of the victories of that era that some people seem to diminish these days, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which became law 50 years ago this summer. Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard University, says that the Civil Rights Act, especially one of its seemingly least controversial provisions, banning discrimination in privately owned places used by the public, is far more consequential than many people seem to think. And he gives it its due in a piece in the June issue of Harper's called The Civil Rights Act's Unsung Victory and How It Changed the South. And he's with us now from a studio in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Kennedy, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You said in the piece that a lot of people don't remember the circumstances that gave rise to this provision, but they have a sense of it from scenes like, for example, I'm thinking in the movie The Butler, where there's a very vivid scene of the lunch counter sit-ins where college students tried to demand service and people are throwing things at them and like pouring, you know, coffee in their faces and so forth. You use a personal experience of your own, and I just wanted to ask if you don't mind telling that story.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I begin the piece by recalling trips that my family would take from Washington, D.C. to Columbia, South Carolina. I was born in Columbia, South Carolina in 1954. My parents left South Carolina when I was quite young. They were refugees from the Jim Crow South. But we went back often. And when we would go back, my mother would, and father, would meticulously pack. And when I was a kid, I thought that this was just all in fun. They would put in lots of candy. They would, you know, devil eggs, chicken. There would just be these coolers full of stuff. And it was only later that I realized and learned why they were so meticulous. They were so meticulous because until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there were lots of places that one could go in the country, particularly in the South. And it was perfectly legal for places of public accommodation to discriminate against people on the basis of race. And my parents wanted to protect us, insulate us against that sort of thing. So that's why they packed so so fully and so meticulously, as I said.
And you talked about these encounters with the white police, which were really designed to humiliate.
Sure. There were certain episodes that I remember really clearly, and this happened a couple of times. We would we'd be a couple of hours into the journey. We might be in, you know, Virginia. We might be as far south as, you know, North Carolina, and a policeman would pull my father over, and he wouldn't give him a ticket or anything. My father would say, you know, officer, have I done anything wrong? The officer would, the times I remember, the officer would say, well, we don't know yet. And the officer would proceed to ask my father some questions. And then he would say, I noticed you're driving a really nice car, and I noticed that your license plate is a Washington, D.C. license plate. You know, we do things differently down here. You do know that. And my father would say, yes, I know that. And then I recall the officers would say again, you do know that. And at that point, my father would say, yes, sir, I know that. Clearly showing that he knew the etiquette of the Jim Crow South. And when the officer was satisfied with that showing, he'd let us go.
Humiliating.
Yeah, of course.
Put you in your place.
It was purposeful. Again, the officer was not, he wasn't himself snarling at my father. I got the sense that, you know, it might very well be that he thought that he was doing my father a favor. Mm. You know, that he was sort of saying, hey, listen, you know, mind your manners, mind your place down here, because we don't mess around with respect to the race line.
Well, the whole question of what the place was is the issue here. right? I mean, you talk about the importance of the Civil Rights Act and what it did. I'll start you off. You say in the piece, in practice, of course, separate but equal, perpetuated an oppressive and humiliating reality to express the judgment that African Americans were inferior and that white people needed to be protected from their contaminating presence. Black people were consigned to the back of the bus, directed to use distinct drinking fountains and telephone booths, excluded altogether from white schools and hospitals, permitted to visit zoos and museums only on certain days. And, it goes on and goes on. What did, and, that was the lived experience, right, of people at that time. So yes. What was the effect of the act? What did it do?
Well, first of all, the act had several parts to it. The part that we're talking about is Title II of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and that's the title that provides that places of public accommodation cannot engage in racial discrimination. So what are we talking about? We're talking about motels. We're talking about hotels. We're talking about restaurants. And again, before 1964, it was perfectly lawful for, a hotel owner to put a big sign out in front of the hotel, whites only, or to put a sign out in front of the restaurant, blacks go round back. That was perfectly lawful.
You make the case pretty insistently that the value of this, the importance of this law has kind of been lost over the years. And I'm curious, first of all, why do you think that? And why do you think that is? Because this is the kind of thing that kids' books, for example, focus on. Because it's for kids, it's intuitively kind of ridiculous that you couldn't go to school together. Like, you say to kids, your friend Pete is white and you're black, so you couldn't go to school together. And people were like, what? That's ridiculous. So why do you think, A, that you say it's been kind of diminished in its importance, and why do you think it's been diminished in importance?
Well, it's been diminished in importance for the same reason that, we often diminish other achievements in our past. We take it for granted. I mean, millions of Americans do not remember the signage that used to litter the Jim Crow South. Negro white, or my favorite, Negro women, white ladies. I mean, you saw this all the time. And this signage, these symbols of inferiority and superiority were all around you, and everybody knew what it meant. White people were superior, black people were inferior. That was the social meaning of all of this.
The other thing you say in the piece is that we should, quote, recognize echoes of the fights from 1964 in current disputes. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you're talking about here?
Sure. I mean, in 1964, it was still the case that there were some politicians who would be just engaged in straight race baiting. But even by 1964, racism had been sufficiently stigmatized such that segregationists were already using a different way of defending their racist position. They were talking about a tyrannical, intrusive federal government. You hear that a little bit nowadays, don't you? They were already talking about intrusions on private property. They were already singing the tune of a certain sort of libertarian argument. Now, of course, Jim Crow segregation was itself dictatorial. It was itself a racist tyranny. But there were people who said, no, libertarianism requires people to be able to do with their property what they will. So in these ways, in the debates that we're having, the debates we have over so-called Obamacare and debates that we have now, even now, over the wisdom of anti-discrimination laws, you can hear echoes of what was going on in 1964.
I want to push a little bit more on this whole question of why you think this is unsung, why you think it might be that something that so changed the day-to-day lives of people is not more, celebrated.
Well, when a victory is won, sometimes you forget about it and don't appreciate it enough. And I think this is what has happened with Title II of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So nowadays, for instance, you hear people, I hear my students when I teach this material, there will be students who will say, what's the big deal about Title II? I mean, you know, what's the big deal about getting a Coca-Cola or a hamburger? And, you know, my response is it was a real big deal. Why was it that people were willing to actually court death over these things? The reason why is because of the symbolism of it. Symbolism is very important. And, you know, this I'm writing a book about the Civil Rights Revolution, and one of the central themes is going to be the importance of symbolism. Oftentimes you'll hear people say, you know, mere symbolism. Well, the Civil Rights Revolution was largely about mere symbolism. Things like a case called Hamilton versus Alabama. And this is a case in which a woman civil rights activist had been arrested for trespass, and she was on trial. And a prosecutor says to her, "Mary, why were you arrested?" And the woman says in response, "My name is Mary Hamilton." The prosecutor says, "Mary, why were you arrested?" And she says, essentially, "You called the other witnesses, the white witnesses, by their last names. My name is Mary Hamilton." The prosecutor says, "Mary, why were you arrested?" She says, "My name is Mary Hamilton, and unless I'm referred to by my correct name, I will not answer." At that point, the prosecutor turns to the judge and says, "I want you to direct the witness to answer." The judge turns to Mary Hamilton and says, "Listen, if you don't answer, I'm going to hold you in criminal contempt of court." She refuses to answer. She is immediately detained and sentenced to jail. She served her sentence. The case went to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court reversed her sentence, but of course, by then she had already served it. You know, it's a very, nobody pays much attention to this case. You won't find this case in many books, but it seems to me that it's a perfect illustration of the point about symbolism and the lengths to which people were willing to go to be treated equally with their fellow citizens, regardless of race.
What is it that you would want us to be thinking about this summer as we think about all that was accomplished during Freedom Summer?
There are a couple of things. Number one, this was not so long ago. We're not talking about a time when, you know, when the dinosaur roamed. This was within the living history of many millions of Americans. So it wasn't so long ago that it was perfectly lawful for restaurant owners to engage in open racial discrimination. And so I guess I want people in a way to take heart from that. We have come a long way, and I think that all Americans should be proud of that. At the same time, we should recognize that we still are in a society that bears the scars of our long racial history.
That was Harvard Law Professor Randall Kennedy. His piece in the June Harper's is "The Civil Rights Act's Unsung Victory," and he was kind enough to join us from Cambridge. Professor, using your proper title, Kennedy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from Andy Mara, a transgender activist who writes about a different kind of freedom, freedom from wondering about her roots and fear of not being accepted. She spoke to us about finding her birth mother in Korea after coming out as transgender. For a regular segment we call In Your Ear, she shared some of the songs that helped her write that story.
My name is Andy Mara, and I am listening to Lullabies by Yuna.
I wanted to go away with you.
She's a Malaysian artist, and she was discovered and brought to the States.
And I will leave all my troubles here.
Her vocals are so dreamy and beautiful, and her voice is very clear, and I love falling asleep to the sound of her music and to the sound of her voice. It puts me into a nice, relaxing state that lets me fall asleep.
I see you in all the pieces in my life. Though you weren't mine, like lullabies, you are forever in my mind. I see you in all the pieces in my life.
Another song I'm listening to is Holocene by Bon Iver.
Somewhere baby, it's part of me, part of me. You ain't waste of hollow. Did friend, it's on its head, it's stuck the street.
It's a perfect song to write to. I particularly like to write to that song when I'm in front of a fireplace and it's quiet outside and it's night out, so it's a wonderful song to write to.
I was not magnificent.
Another song I really love is Go Do by Jonesy. It's a wonderfully happy and exuberant song. It has a lot of pep. And it reminds me of the fall of 2010 when I found my family in Korea and I was able to begin building a relationship with them. So it has a lot of great memories and it's very motivational for me when I'm feeling down. Another song I really, really love is The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams. It's more of a classical piece, but again, it's a wonderful song to write to, especially when you're feeling reflective and introspective, if you will. I love playing the piece when I am sitting down, when it's raining outside, and writing more thoughtful, meaningful pieces.
That was Andy Mara telling us what's playing in her ear. If you want to listen to our previous conversation, just head to npr.org/tellmemore. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle.